Lecture 78, Nixon and Watergate.
Last time, we studied the women's movement in the second half of the 20th century. Now I want to zoom in again closely to the narrative of events, picking up the story in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Richard Nixon, a Quaker, but also a World War II veteran, made his political reputation as a harsh, anti-communist Republican congressman in the late 1940s. Eisenhower chose him as his running mate in the presidential election of 1952. But despite his 8 years of experience as vice president, he then narrowly lost to John F. Kennedy in the election of 1960. Repairing his political image, he made a comeback in 1968 and defeated Hubert Humphrey to win the presidency in the election of 68. Accepting the largely bipartisan Cold War consensus, he continued the American role in Vietnam, accepted much of the heritage of the Great Society from Lyndon Johnson, and even tinkered with the idea of a guaranteed national income. So by his later Republican successors' standards, he was a center or even liberal Republican. His opponent in the 1972 election, George McGovern, was the weakest Democratic candidate in years, perhaps in the century, whom Nixon would certainly have defeated in a fair fight. So Nixon's unnecessary decision to eavesdrop electronically on the McGovern campaign in the Watergate complex during the summer of 1972 led to the arrest of his agents, the Plumbers. Nixon won easily that fall, but was ruined by an escalating series of revelations over the next 2 years. They showed that he'd known of the break-ins almost from the beginning and that he'd tried to orchestrate a cover-up. Congressional investigations and an imminent impeachment finally forced him to resign in disgrace in the summer of 1974. Well, back briefly to his early career, which marked him as a very able and talented politician. Like John F. Kennedy, and like many people whose political careers were built in the second half of the century, he first entered Congress in 1946. He came from California and was a graduate of Whittier College, which is in Southern California, and then of Duke University Law School. And he had a distinguished military record from the Pacific Theater in World War II. He first became prominent in national life because of his support for Whittaker Chambers in the Alger Hiss espionage case. He believed that Chambers was right, that Hiss really had been a spy, and did everything he could to promote the cause of Hiss's prosecution and conviction. And he got a lot of favorable publicity for his own role in the case, including some very sensational revelations, such as the fact that Chambers at one point had hollowed out a pumpkin and hidden some stolen microfilms inside the pumpkin, and the pumpkin papers became one of the celebrated incidents in the Alger Hiss case. So in 1950, after 2 terms in the House of Representatives, Nixon campaigned for the Senate, a Senate seat from California. He campaigned against a woman called Helen Gehagan Douglas, and made the classic allegation of that year, 1950, that she was soft on communism, and actually mixing red baiting with sexism. He said, she's pink right down to her underwear. Pink meaning not actually red like a real communist, but pink in the sense of being contaminated by pseudo-communist ideas. Well, he was Eisenhower's running mate in 1952, and was able to fight off various challenges to his candidacy. Eisenhower himself had previously had no political experience, except in strictly military-related matters. He'd always maintained the principle, which has been honored throughout American history, that the soldiers must not get involved in politics. And as a career soldier and one of the premier American generals of World War II, he'd stayed out of it. Both parties wanted Eisenhower, but the Republicans finally got him. And Nixon was brought onto the ticket, really, as the hatchet man to do the hard political work to enable Eisenhower to seem to be above the fray. And as I mentioned in the lecture on television, the Checkers speech, whereby he admitted that although he hadn't taken any illegal campaign contributions, he and his children had accepted a Cocker Spaniel dog. That was the political speech which generated a lot of support for his candidacy and enabled him to stay on the ticket when his candidacy and his political future had appeared to be jeopardized. Well, during his 8 years as president, Eisenhower restricted Nixon's actual political role. It's often the case that the vice president is in a constricted position, On the one hand, he's a heartbeat from the presidency. That's the great cliche about it. But on the other hand, the vice president has often had very little to do. It's certainly the case that Johnson was kept very, very much in the background by Kennedy. Truman had been kept completely in the background by Roosevelt. And similarly, Nixon was kept in a strictly subordinate role by Eisenhower. Eisenhower passed the mantle to Nixon in 1960. But Nixon lost in one of the narrowest elections of the century to John F. Kennedy. In 1962, attempting to repair his political fortunes, he ran for the job of governor of California, hoping that he could then restore his fortunes, but lost again to Pat Brown, Edmund Brown Sr., and seemed to be finished. Not many candidates can lose two elections, first a national one, then a local one, and revive their careers. And at a famous press conference, after losing the gubernatorial election in California, his usual reserve broke down, and he said to the press, "You won't have old Dick Nixon to kick around anymore." Normally he was very stiff and reserved, but his temper got the better of him. His early success with the press back in the late 40s had given way to mutual suspicion and mistrust, and he already had the nickname of Tricky Dick Nixon, someone who wasn't quite to be trusted. Gary Wills, the journalist, made a famous hostile description of Nixon by Gary Wills a few years later. Here's what Wills wrote. Quote, "His famous nose looks detachable. In pictures, its most striking aspect is the ski jump silhouette. But the aspect that awes one when he meets Nixon is its distressing width, accentuated by the depths of the ravine running down its center and by its general fuzziness. The nose swings far out, then underneath. It does not rejoin the face in a straight line, but curves far up again, leaving a large but partially screened space between nose and lip. One feels guilty noticing such things. It is embarrassing to feel oneself sinking to the level of Mitch Miller at the Miss America contest. And yet, that very sensation increases the difficulty of listening to Nixon's words. One does not like to feel embarrassed by a president." That must explain a good deal of the popular antipathy to Nixon. One is embarrassed to keep meeting the dog one kicked yesterday. That's a lovely example of the new journalism, where, the journalist's emotions and feelings, in this case a feeling of dislike, is communicated by this long and painful description. Well, after his defeat in 62, Nixon moved to New York and worked through much of the 60s as a lawyer, while always planning a comeback and building up his sources of support inside the Republican Party. The fact that the Republicans' presidential candidate in 64, Barry Goldwater, lost disastrously made him the senior presiding Republican who was still standing in the aftermath of that debacle. And so it was from 64 that he was able to rebuild his plausibility as the man around whom the Republican ranks could gather. And in the election of 1968, he was able to do that, taking advantage of the social upheavals of the decade to strengthen the Republican Party in general and his own role within it. He realized in 68 that white Southerners were now willing to vote Republican. One of his strategists was Kevin Phillips, who'd written a very, very influential book, The Emerging Republican Majority, noting this trend, that the Democratic white South had been absolutely solid for the best part of a century, ever since the end of Reconstruction. But that as the Democrats progressively endorsed civil rights legislation, and as they endorsed the idea of encouraging black votes, Southern whites were going to be disillusioned and leave the Democratic Party, and the Republicans could pick them up instead. Southern white Democrats certainly were fiercely opposed to policies like affirmative action, and therefore were that much readier to vote Republican. And Nixon, in his campaign of 68, appealed for the support of what he called the silent majority. That is, people who weren't out demonstrating in the streets, but nevertheless had jobs and adhere to traditional American values, which he said are being violated by the radical extremists. One of his challenges in 68 was George Wallace, the Alabama segregationist, who'd now become an independent candidate for the presidency. One of Nixon's principal issues was law and order, but that was one of the issues that Wallace was also pursuing. And George Wallace had a great genius for inflammatory rhetoric, particularly against the students who were protesting against the Vietnam War. People with long hair, the draft dodgers, the pot smokers, and the counterculture in general. and also the welfare cheats, people who, he said, were now enriching themselves because of the naivety of President Johnson's war on poverty programs, which to Wallace seemed far too general. So Nixon had a problem differentiating himself from Wallace, because these were the kinds of issues on which he might be able to work as well. But in the end, Nixon was able to win the victory. He got 31 million votes. Wallace got about 10 million. And the Democrats, after their very, very bruising and destructive convention in Chicago that summer, and disillusioned by the fallout from the Vietnam War, which had progressively demoralized the Johnson presidency, were defeated. Nixon's use of the media was very, very disciplined, as was the Republicans' convention in Miami. So comparing the two conventions in 68, the Republicans were tight and well-organized, and the Democrats, by comparison, seemed like a hopeless mess. I mentioned previously that Joe McGinnis wrote a book about this campaign called The Selling of the President, in which the candidate was turned into something like a commodity and marketed very effectively. Nixon undertook important foreign policy initiatives. Perhaps most important of all, he opened diplomatic negotiations with China. Ever since 1949 and the end of the Chinese Revolution, when Mao had taken control, the American government had granted diplomatic recognition to Taiwan, that is to Chiang Kai-shek and his successors, the defeated nationalist minority who'd been overpowered in the Civil War. But it was increasingly anomalous that right through the 50s and right through the 60s, America should decline to have diplomatic relations with one of the most populous nations of the earth, which potentially in the future was going to become a very powerful nation as well. So Nixon's national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, made a series of secret trips to China to open up the question of diplomatic relations between the two. And then in one of the most amazing events of 1972, Nixon publicly made a dramatic visit to China. He told his staff beforehand, quote, "A fourth of the world's people live in communist China. Today, they're not a significant power, but 25 years from now, they could be decisive." For the United States not to do what it can at this time, when it can, would lead to a situation of great danger. We could have total détente with the Soviet Union, but that would mean nothing if the Chinese were still outside the international community. Well, Nixon's visit in 72, which included a series of high-profile banquets in Beijing and a visit to the Great Wall of China, began the slow reincorporation of China into the American diplomatic world. Full relations were established in 1979 under President Carter. One of the advantages of diplomatic relations with China was this. At first, back in 49, it had seemed as though Russia and China, now that they were both communists, were going to be allies. In fact, there were all kinds of unresolved issues between the two, leading to great intra-communist tension. And Nixon understood perfectly that if he was on good terms with the Chinese, that in turn would provide some diplomatic leverage over against the Russians. But at the same time, he also believed in the importance of keeping the Cold War from escalating to a catastrophic nuclear exchange. Throughout the whole of this period, the American-Soviet encounter is the single biggest foreign policy issue, even though often it seems to be just frozen in place. Nevertheless, it was always there, and everything else revolved around it. So it, also in 72, his negotiators completed the SALT I treaty with the Russians, SALT, Strategic Arms Limitation Talks. This led to another dramatic visit, this time to Moscow, also in 1972, shortly after the visit to China, when both sides agreed to limit their missile buildup. It also included the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, in which both sides agreed not to build defensive missile systems because, although they look defensive, they can be interpreted as having an aggressive or offensive spirit, because it leads to the possibility that one side will launch its own missiles against the adversary and then shoot down the retaliatory strike with its own anti-ballistic missiles. So those were prohibited. And it was Nixon who, haltingly and slowly, extricated the Americans from the Vietnam War. He reduced the American presence there from 500,000 when he came into office to 70,000 in the first 2 years, and ran a program which he called Vietnamization. That is, handing over the actual running of the war to the people of South Vietnam themselves. And finally, he withdrew the last Americans in 1973 after abolishing the draft, which was one of the things which had made the war so bitterly hated that generations of young men were jeopardized by being drafted to fight in a war they thought was morally wrong. But the slowness with which he did it, it stretched out over 4 years, and the fact that it included along the way such incidents as the saturation bombing of the Vietnamese cities and the invasion of Cambodia, the adjacent country, which in turn had stimulated the Kent State massacre, the shootings by students at Kent State, meant that he remained as hated a figure by the American political left as Johnson had been. In other words, Nixon's early allegations that he'd bring the war to a quick end were nullified. Well, in fact, he wasn't able to preserve South Vietnam's permanent viability. And the ensuing events made it impossible, when North Vietnam invaded the South, made it impossible for the Americans to recommit militarily in the area, with the result that in 1975, Saigon finally fell and the war came to an end with a complete defeat of South Vietnam. Nixon's domestic policies accepted most of the legacy of Johnson's Great Society, partly because Nixon had to. Both houses of Congress were in Democratic hands in his first administration. School desegregation went forward faster now than it had in either of the Democratic administrations preceding it. But that was partly because Congress was being run by the Democrats who were committed to it, and also because the courts themselves were adjudicating racial questions in a way which was designed to encourage actual racial integration. One colourful figure from the era was Nixon's vice president, Spiro Agnew. He was the former governor of Maryland. And he was the man who travelled widely and publicised the administration's dislike of radicals and also its dislike of the media, which Nixon had concluded was one of the great allies of the disruptive forces in American society. Agnew was the Republicans' leading fundraiser in Nixon's first administration. And he had some wonderful speechmakers who came up with phrases like this. The press, he described them as an effete core of impudent snobs and of people who were saying that American foreign policy was disastrously misleading. He called these critics the nattering nabobs of negativism. So wonderful phrases issuing from Agnew's lips. Well, the Watergate break-in of 1972 changed everything. It was unnecessary, and it ruined Nixon. It's like a Shakespearean tragedy in a way, where the hero, despite his great virtues and merits, reaches too high, and one fatal inner flaw brings him crashing down to defeat. You can see Nixon that way, and it's very tempting to do so. Early in 1972, he was on top of the world. He'd been to China, he'd been to Russia. He'd begun to transform the outlines of the Cold War in what looked like a very benign way. This is an era remembered by the name détente, you know, the settling of differences. Nixon had also presided over the first moon landing back in 1969 when Apollo 11 successfully took Armstrong and Aldrin to the moon and back. And of course, Nixon got some of the reflected glory from that as well. And yet, a few years later, he had to resign in absolute disgrace. Well, a group of burglars called the Plumbers bugged the Democratic Party's headquarters in the Watergate complex, which is a building complex in Washington. But they were caught doing it. James McCord was their leader, and he and four others were arrested. They denied that they had any kind of link to the White House, but McCord himself was an employee of an organization called CREEP, the Committee to Re-elect the President. Two Washington Post journalists heard about the break-in, Robert Woodward and Carl Bernstein, and they pursued the story tenaciously. At first, the Washington Post's editors were a little bit lukewarm about the story. They also thought at first it was probably that the break-in was unconnected with the election. And so at first, the story was buried on the inside pages. But Woodward and Bernstein were convinced that there were links to the White House, and they wouldn't let go. In fact, they cultivated sources who enabled them to trace links all the way back to the Oval Office. One of their most important informants was called Deep Throat, at least that was the nickname. This is taken from a popular pornographic film of the time. And the identity of Deep Throat has remained mysterious right up to the present. They wrote a spellbinding book about their work, which later on became a film, All the President's Men, starring Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman. And really, this is the classic case of the so-called Fourth Estate, the press, playing a vital role in politics, and in this case, clearly a benign one, in bringing to justice a rogue presidential campaign. Nixon won the election of 1972 easily. The Democratic candidate, George McGovern, from South Dakota, represented the Democratic left. And the Democratic left certainly had a very, very passionate following, but only among a minority of the voters. And of course, the great issue in a presidential election is to find a way of getting 50% of the electorate, plus a bit more, on your side, because 51% of the votes can give you 100% of the power. McGovern was very unlikely ever to be able to do that. And his position worsened as his campaign went on, because his running mate, Thomas Eagleton, it was disclosed that Eagleton had a series of electric shock therapies when he suffered from depression and therefore had a kind of medical liability. At first, McGovern said, "I'm 1,000% behind him. In other words, I'll stand up for him at all costs." But then, when the pressure got too great, he dropped him and picked up Sergeant Shriver instead, a member of the big Kennedy political family. And that made McGovern seem weak and indecisive. When the election of November 72 actually took place, it was just as lopsided against the Democrats as Goldwater's defeat had been lopsided against the Republicans back in 1964. There had been another very, very likely and viable Democratic candidate for president, Edward Kennedy, the brother of the slain former president and the slain former attorney general. But Edward Kennedy had become politically vulnerable because in 1969, the Chappaquiddick Ferry affair had taken place. A young woman who he appeared to have been having a sexual affair with was drowned in a car which he was driving, and he fled from the scene, leaving her to her death. So ever since then, the Chappaquiddick scandal dogged Edward Kennedy and prevented him from becoming a viable presidential candidate, even though he retained the loyalty of the Massachusetts Democrats whom he represented. George Wallace, this time campaigning as one of the Democrats rather than as an independent, was shot and paralyzed during the Democratic primary campaigns, so that took him out as well, leaving McGovern in a severely compromised position, which in turn led to a severe defeat. Now, Nixon, re-inaugurated, was in a very, very awkward position because he had to appear to be prosecuting Watergate as vigorously as possible, prosecuting the investigation, while simultaneously involved in covering it up. And it must have led to some awful mental gymnastics inside his own mind. He appeared on national television on April the 30th, 1973, hoping to carry off another coup comparable to the one he'd done in the days of the Great Checkers affair back in 1952. He was sitting with a bust of Lincoln on one side, the first great Republican president, and a photograph of his family on the other side. And in his speech, he said, "There can be no whitewash at the White House." He said he'd track down the wrongdoers and bring them to justice. And he appointed a Harvard professor of law, Archibald Cox, as the special prosecutor to investigate the charges. What followed was a series of national hearings by a United States Senate committee through the summer of 1973, and they drew massive audiences. Bit by bit, they started finding, with the help of journalists like Woodward and Bernstein, they began to find evidence that Nixon and his aides had been involved in burglary, bribery, spying on the sex lives of their political opponents, blackmail, destruction of evidence, perjury, and even pledges of executive pardons to perpetrators who kept quiet. Gradually, an enormous array of criminal activities by people close to the president were disclosed. And really, the great remaining ambiguity was this. How much did the president know of these activities which were going on in his name? Did he try to stop them, or did he actually try to encourage and orchestrate them? The greatest breakthrough in the Watergate investigations came when investigators discovered, again to their astonishment, that Nixon had got tape recordings of all his conversations in the Oval Office. Now, of course, as soon as the existence of these tapes appeared, the Senate Investigating Committee said that he should hand them over so that they could play all the tapes and listen. If every conversation was recorded, they'd soon find out how much Nixon had known and how much he tried to cover up. But Nixon refused to hand them over, claiming executive privilege. That is, that there's a kind of a penumbra, a grey area, which protects a president from having to make full disclosure during his term of office for reasons of national security and other things. But eventually he was forced to turn the tapes over, and they incriminated him. He had a loyal executive secretary of 20 years standing called Rosemary Woods. And she had the job of transcribing the tapes, which would then be handed to the investigators. But on one of the tapes, she erased several minutes, 18 minutes, of extremely incriminating information. And when asked how she'd done that, she claimed it was an accident with the dictaphone, but people actually recreated her bodily movements to show that you couldn't possibly erase these 18 minutes if you hadn't intended to be able to do so. Besides, it wasn't only the passage which was deleted which proved damaging to the White House, because it showed that Nixon, particularly in conversations with Haldeman and Ehrlichman, two of his closest advisors, had used extremely bad language and aggressive, insulting descriptions of all their potential antagonists. And it was this bad language which, as much as anything, horrified the nation. The transcripts were full of racial slurs, threats, and bad language. And in the actual official transcripts, every time a swear word was used, the transcript says, expletive, deleted. In other words, it wouldn't actually say the bad words. But expletive deleted itself became a sort of standard way of avoiding using profanity in the 1970s. Of course, investigators and historians and everybody interested in Watergate said this: why on earth didn't he destroy the tapes? Once the investigations had heated up, he must have foreseen that they were going to become a crucial part of the evidence. It may be that Nixon was so obsessed with the idea that he was a historically vital character that he remained confident that historians would vindicate his commission of illegal acts in view of the good ends to which they were directed. There's a dispute among historians about exactly why he didn't destroy them when he could have done. What makes it particularly poignant is this also, that Lyndon Johnson had also had secret tape recording equipment, but when Nixon had come into the Oval Office, his first thought had been, well, we don't need all this stuff, and had ordered it to be taken away. But he'd only been there for a while before he had it all brought back again with updated generations of tape recording and so on to bring it in. In 71, he'd had it all put back, principally to vindicate his Vietnam policy, which he was convinced was right-minded. There was also, certainly, by the way, a long tradition of spying on one's political enemies. We know that Franklin Roosevelt had done it, and we know that John F. Kennedy had done it as well. They'd bugged their opponents, they'd spied on them. This was the dirty underside of American political life throughout most of the 20th century. But perhaps an even more intriguing question is this: why had he performed the bugging in the first place? Surely Nixon was politically savvy enough to know that he would win anyway. Certainly any Republican president, any Republican candidate, would have been jubilant at the prospect of running against George McGovern, whom all the polls showed was destined to lose. Well, in the summer of 1974, the House of Representatives prepared to indict Nixon for high crimes and misdemeanors, that is, to have him impeached. And also, Congress denied Nixon's appeal for renewed military efforts in Vietnam. The agreement which had been worked out between the Americans and South Vietnam and the North had been violated by the North. It had invaded South Vietnam. Nixon wanted the army to go back to continue to shore up the South Vietnamese regime. But by now, Congress said no. It's too politically unpopular. The idea of arousing again all the demons of the late 60s and the bitter unpopularity of this policy for a very dubious gain, the defense of South Vietnam, which can't defend itself, is simply not going to happen. In fact, the Watergate scandal was very, very disruptive to the regular political process and hamstrung American foreign policy for 2 years. Faced with impeachment and the overwhelming probability that he would be convicted, Nixon finally resigned, denying to the end that he'd done anything wrong. And later on, in retirement, he lived throughout the rest of the 70s, 80s, and into the 1990s. He wrote his memoirs and several very, very good books on foreign policy, demonstrating to anyone who doubted it that he was an extremely skillful and talented politician and historian, even though he also had fatal weaknesses. Now, Vice President Gerald Ford took over until the next presidential election could take place in 1976. The reason Ford was vice president was because not only had Nixon had to resign, his vice president, Spiro Agnew, had also had to go, because further revelations by crusading journalists in the early 70s showed that Agnew, when he'd been governor of Maryland, had himself been accepting bribes in return for state contracts. So Agnew was forced to resign in disgrace first, then Nixon, and that left Gerald Ford, who'd previously been a respected Michigan politician, in control, at least until the election of 1976. The combination of the Vietnam War and then the Watergate scandal created a sour mood of suspicion and betrayal inside the United States. A very, very high level of popular skepticism and disillusionment. I mentioned earlier that this is the era when question authority stickers begin to spread. And by the mid-1970s, a large section of the American population, not just extremists, but even ordinary mainstream voters, woke up to the fact that, unfortunately, their own government could lie to them, and sometimes would do so routinely. And that the fact of being an important office holder did not necessarily make you a person of high principle and probity. It was a dismaying moment, a dismaying insight, which had a great impact on what happened in the election of 1976.